Planet the Moor, right on him. Yes. Yes, it was. It appears to me that these coups can be brought off only by enormous pains, forethought, preparation, or by taking them on the volley. And for that a very particular quality is required, a virtue I hardly know how to name. Baraka, say the Moors. He possesses it in a high degree, and what would be criminal temerity in another man is right conduct in him. Yet I left him in a sponging house at Portsmouth. Amazement. Concern. Yes. His virtue seems to apply only at sea, or in his maritime character. He was arrested for debt at the instance of a coven of attorneys. Fanshawe, his agent, tells me it was for a sum of £700. Captain Aubrey was aware that the Spanish treasure was not to be regarded as prize, but he had no notion that the news had spread in England. Nor, I must confess, had I, since there has been no official announcement. However, I must not importune you with private discontents. My dear sir, my dear Maturin, I beg you will always speak to me as a personal friend. A friend who has a great esteem for you, quite apart from all official considerations. That is kind, Sir Joseph, it is very kind. Then I will tell you that I fear his other creditors may get wind of his renewed difficulties, and so load him with processes that he will be hopelessly involved. My means do not allow me to extricate him, and although the ex gratia payment you were good enough to mention may eventually extinguish the greater part of his debt, it will leave a considerable sum. And a man may rot in prison as thoroughly for a few hundred as for £10,000. Has it not been paid? No, sir. And I detect a certain reluctance in Fanshawe to make an advance upon it. These things are so unusual, says he, the event dubious, the delay unknown, and his capital was so very much engaged. It's not my province, of course. The sluggish transport board and the still more sluggish ticket office have to pass the vouchers. But I think I can promise something like dispatch. In the meantime, Mr. Carling will speak a private word to Fanshawe, and I'm sure you will be able to draw on him for the sum you mention. Mention. Should you like a window open, Sir Joseph? If it would not incommode you, do you not find it a trifle warm yourself? I do not. The tropic sun is what I require, and a bushel of sea coals is its nearest equivalent, but it would scarcely answer for a normally constituted frame, I agree. Pray, take off your coat, loosen your neckcloth. I do not stand on ceremony, as you see, with my nightcap and catskin comforter. He began to heave on a system of cords and purchases connected with the window, but sank back, muttering, "Jesus, Mary and Joseph, no grip, no grip at all." "Bondon!" "Sir," said Bondon, instantly appearing at the door. "Just clap onto that slab line and tally and belay right aft, will you now?" said Stephen, glancing at Sir Joseph with covert pride. Bondengate caught the doctor's intention and moved forward. But with his hand on the rope, he paused and said, "But I don't hardly know, sir, that draught would be the thing. We ain't so spry this morning." "You see how it is, Sir Joseph. Discipline all to pieces, never an order carried out without endless wrangling. Damn you, sir." Bonden sulkily opened the window an inch or two, poked the fire, and left the room, shaking his head. "I believe I shall take off my coat," said Sir Joseph. "So a warm climate would suit, you tell me?"
"The hotter the better. As soon as I can, I mean to go down to Bath to wallow in the warm and sulphurous..."
"Just what I was about to observe," cried Sir Joseph. "I'm delighted to hear it. It was the very thing I should have recommended if...
If you had not looked so very savage, explosive, obstinate, and cantankerous, he thought, but said, if it had been my place to advise you. The very thing to brace the fibres. My sister Clarges knew of a case, not perhaps quite identical. He felt he was on dangerous ground, coughed, and without a transition said, but to return to your friend, will not his marriage set him up? I saw the announcement in the Times, and surely I understand the young lady to be a very considerable heiress. Lady Keith told me the estate is very handsome, some of the best farmland in the county. That is so, sure, but it is in her mother's hands entirely, and this mother is the most unromantic beast that ever urged its squat, thick bulk across the face of the protesting earth, whereas Jack is not. He has the strangest notions of what constitutes a scrub, and the greatest contempt for a fortune hunter. A romantic creature, and the most pitiful liar you can imagine. When I had to tell him the Spanish treasure was not prize, but that he was a pauper again, he feigned to have known it a great while. Laughed, comforted me as tender as a woman, said he had been quite resigned to it these months past, desired me not to fret, he didn't mind it. But I know all that night he wrote to Sophia, and I am morally certain he released her from her engagement. Not that that will have the slightest effect upon her, the honey bun, he added, leaning back on his pillows with a smile. Bonden walked in, staggering under the weight of two butts of coal, and made up the fire. Sir Joseph, you will take some coffee? Perhaps a glass of Madeira. They have an excellent sersial here that I can conscientiously recommend. Thank you, thank you. Perhaps I might have a glass of water. A glass of cold water would be most acceptable. A glass of water, Bonden, if you please. And a decanter of Madeira. And if I find another raw egg beaten up in rum on the tray, Bonden, I shall fling it at your head. That, he said, sipping his wine, was the most painful aspect of my journey, the breaking of my news. Even more painful than the fact that my, let us call it, interrogation was carried out by the French, the nation I love best. What civilized man does not? Their rulers, politicians, revolutions set apart, and this horrible engouement for Bonaparte? Just so. But these were not new men. Dutour was an engineer, ancien régime, and Auger dragoon. Regular, traditional officers. That was the horrible part. I thought I knew the nation through and through, lived there, studied in Paris. However, Jack Aubrey had a short way with him. Yes. As I was saying, he is a romantic creature. After this affair, he tossed his sword into the sea, though I know the value he had for it. Then again, he loves to make war. No man more eager in the article of battle. But afterwards, it is as though he didn't feel that war consisted of killing your opponents. There's a contradiction here. "I'm so glad you're going to the bath," said Sir Joseph, whom the conflicts within the heart of a frigate captain he had never seen interested less than the restoration of his friend's health. For although in ordinary relationships the chief of naval intelligence more nearly resembled an iceberg than a human being, he had a real affection, a real warmth of affection for Maturin. "I am delighted because you will meet my successor there. And I shall be down from time to time. I shall look forward extremely to enjoying your company, and to bringing you better acquainted with him." He felt the strength of Stephen's gaze at the word successor, relished it for a moment, and went on. "Yes, I shall be retiring presently to my Sabine beetles. I have a little place in the Fens, a
paradise for Coleoptera. How I look forward to it, not without a certain regret, of course. Yet this is lessened by the fact that I leave my concerns, our concerns, in good hands. You are acquainted with the gentleman?
Indeed.
Yes. When you desired me to send a confidential person to take down your report because of the state of your hands, oh, it was barbarous, barbarous to have used you so. I begged Mr. Waring to come. You sat with him for 2 hours, he said, savouring the triumph.
You astonish me. I'm amazed, said Stephen crossly.
But then a smile spread across his face. That Subfusc, entirely unremarkable man, that Mr. Waring, would answer charmingly. He had done his work with no fuss of any kind, efficiently, and his only questions had been immediately to the point. He had given nothing away, no special knowledge, no particular interest, and he might have been some dull, respectable civil servant in the middle reaches of the hierarchy.
He has the greatest admiration for your work and a thorough grasp of the situation. Admiral Sivright will appear for him, a much better system, but you will deal directly with him when I am gone. You will agree very well, I'm sure. He is a professional. It was he who dealt with the late Monsieur de la Tapeterie. I believe, by the by, that you gave him to understand that you had some other papers or observations that lay somewhat outside the limits of your report.
Yes. If you will be so good as to pass me that leather-covered object.
Thank you.
The Confederatio burnt the house. How those fellows love a blaze. But before we left, I desired their chief to remove the important papers from which I offer you this as a personal present for your retirement. It comes to you by right, since your name appears in it. Les agissements néfastes de Sir Blaine, on page 3, and Le perfide Sir Blaine, on page 7. It is a report drawn up nominally by Colonel Auger, but in fact by the far more brilliant Dutour for your homologue in Paris, showing the present state of their military intelligence network in the eastern part of the peninsula, including Gibraltar. With appreciation of the agents, details of payment, and so on. It's not finished, because the gentleman was cut short in mid-paragraph, but it is tolerably complete, and authentic even to the very bloodstains. You will find a certain number of surprises, particularly Mr. Judas Griffiths. But on the whole, I hope it will gratify you. Oh, that we had such a document for England! In my yesterday's state of knowledge, it seemed to me a document that should pass from my hands directly to yours, he said, handing it over. Sir Joseph plucked it from him with a glittering eye, hurried over to the light, and sat there, hunched sideways, devouring the neat pages, accounts, and lists. "The dock," he exclaimed in an undertone. "The cunning dock. Edward Griffiths. Edward Griffiths, say your prayers, my man. In the very embassy itself? So Osborne was right. The hound. God bless my soul."
"Well," he said aloud, "I shall have to share this with my colleagues at the Horse Guards and the Foreign Office, of course. But the document itself I shall keep. Le perfide Sir Blaine, to gloat upon in my leisure at ease. Such a document! I'm so grateful, Maturin." He made as though to shake hands, but recollected himself at the sight of Stevens, touched it gently, and said, "If it comes to exchanging surprises, I own myself beat out of the ring. The postman was a rare visitor to Mapes. Mrs. Williams's bailiff lived in the village, and her man of business called on her once a week. She had few relations with whom she was on letter-writing terms, and those few wrote seldom. Yet to the eldest daughter of the house, the postman's step, his way of opening the iron gate, was perfectly distinct, and as soon as she heard it, she flew from the still-room along three corridors and down the stairs into the hall. She was too late, however. The butler had already placed the lady's fashionable intelligencer and a single letter on his salver, and he was walking towards the breakfast-room. "Is there anything for me, John?" she cried. "Just the magazine and a threepenny one, Miss Sophia," said the butler. "I'm taking them to my mistress." Sophia instantly detected the evasion and said, "Give me that letter at once, John." "My mistress says I'm to take everything to her to prevent mistakes." "You must give it to me directly. You could be taken up and hanged for keeping people's letters. It's against the law." "Oh, Miss Sophie, it won't be as much as my place is worth." At this point, Mrs. Williams came out of the breakfast-room, took the post and disappeared, her black eyebrows joining on her forehead. Sophie followed her, heard the rip of the cover, and said, "Mama, give me my letter." Mrs. Williams turned her angry, dark red face to her daughter and cried, "Do you give orders in this house, miss? For shame! I forbade you to correspond with that felon." "He is not a felon."
"Then what is he in prison for?"
"You know perfectly well, Mama, it is for debt.
In my opinion, that is worse. Defrauding people of their money is far worse than knocking them on the head. It is aggravated felony. Anyhow, I have forbidden you to correspond."
"We are engaged to be married. We have every right to correspond. I'm not a child."
"Stuff! I never gave more than a conditional consent, and now it's all over. I'm quite ill and weary with telling you so. All these fine words of his. So much pretense. We had a narrow escape. Many unprotected women have been taken in by fine words and high-flown, specious promises with not a scrap of solid government stock to support them when it comes to the point. You say you're not a child, but you are a child in these matters, and you need protecting. That is why I mean to read your letters. If you have nothing to be ashamed of, why should you object? Innocence is its own shield, I've always found. How cross and wicked you look. Oh, fie upon you, Sophia. But I'm not going to let you be made a victim of by the first man that takes a fancy to your fortune, miss, I can tell you. I shall have no hugger-mugger correspondence in my house. There's been enough of that with your cousin going into keeping or coming upon the town or whatever you like to call it in your modern flash way of speaking. There was nothing of that kind when I was a girl. But then in my day, no girl would ever have been so bold as to speak to her mother like that, nor so wickedly undutiful. Even the most brazen chit would have died of shame first, I'm very sure." Mrs. Williams' spate flowed slower during the last sentences, for she was greedily reading as she spoke. "Anyhow," she said, "all this headstrong violence of yours is quite unnecessary. You've brought on my migraine for nothing. The letter's from Dr. Maturin, and you need not blush to have it read."
"My dear Miss Williams, I must beg your pardon for dictating this letter. A misfortune to my hand makes it difficult for me to write. I at once executed the commission you were kind enough to honour me with, and I was so fortunate as to obtain all the books on your list through my bookseller, the respectable Mr. Bentley, who allows me a discount of 30%. Something like pinched approval showed in the lower parts of Mrs. Williams's face. "What is more, I have a messenger in the shape of the Reverend Mr. Hinksey, the new rector of Swiving Monachorum, who will be passing through Champflower on his way to be read in, or inducted, as I believe I should say.
quite right. We say inducted for a clergyman. Last, Sophie, we shall be the first to see him. Mrs. Williams's moods were violent, but changeable. He has a vast carriage, and being as yet unprovided with a family, undertakes to place Clark of Eldin, Duhamel, Falconer, and the rest on the seat, which will save you not only the waiting, but also the sum of half a crown, which is not to be despised. No, indeed. 8 of them make a pound. Not that some fine gentlemen seem to think so. I rejoice to hear that you will be at Bath, since this will afford me the pleasure of paying my respects to your mamma. I shall be there from the 20th, but I trust this visit may not mean a decline in her health, or any uneasiness about her former complaint. He's always so considerate about my sufferings. He really might do for Sissy. If she could get him, that would mean a physician in the family always at hand. And what does a little popery signify? We're all Christians, I believe.
Pray tell her that if I can be of any service, I am at her command. My direction will be at Lady Keith's in Lansdowne Crescent. I shall be alone as Captain Aubrey is detained in Portsmouth.
He's quite my way of thinking, I see, has cut off all connections like a well-judging man.
And so, my dear Miss Williams, with my best compliments to your mamma, to Miss Cecilia, and to Miss Frances,
and so on and so forth. A very pretty respectful letter, quite properly expressed, though he might have found a frank among all his acquaintances, a man's hand, I see, not a woman's. He must certainly have dictated this letter to a gentleman. You may have it, Sophie. I shall not at all object to seeing Dr. Matchelin in Bath. He's a sensible man. He is no spendthrift. He might do very well for Cecilia. Never was a gentleman that needed a wife more, and certainly your sister's in need of a husband. With all these militia officers about and the example she has had, there'll be no holding her. The sooner she's safely married, the better. I desire you will leave them together as much as possible in Bath.
Bath, with its terraces rising one above another in the sun, the abbey and the waters, the rays of the sun slanting through the steam, and Sir Joseph Blaine and Mr. Waring walking up and down the gallery of the King's Bath, in which Stephen sat boiling himself to total relaxation, dressed in a canvas shift and lodged in a stone niche, looking Gothic. Other male images sat in a range either side of him, some scrofulous, rheumatic, gouty or phthisical, others merely too fat, gazing without much interest at female images, many of them in the same case on the other side, while a dozen pilgrims stumbled about in the water supported by attendants. The powerful form of Bondon in canvas drawers surged through the stream to Stephen's niche, handed him out, and walked him up and down, calling, "By your leave, ma'am, make a line there, mate," with complete self-possession, this being his element, whatever the temperature. "He's doing far better today," said Sir Joseph.
"Far better," said Mr. Waring. "He walked the best part of a mile on Thursday, and to Carlo's yesterday. I should never have believed it possible. You saw his body?"
"Only his hands,"
said Sir Joseph, closing his eyes.
"He must have uncommon strength of will, uncommon strength of constitution."
He has,"
said Sir Joseph, and they walked up and down again for a while.
"He's going back to his seat. See? He climbs in quite nimbly. The waters have done him the world of good. I recommended them. He will be going up to Lansdowne Crescent in a few minutes. Perhaps we might walk slowly up through the town. I am childishly eager to speak to him."
"Strong. Yes, certainly strong," he said,
threading through the crowd. "Let us cross into the sun. What a magnificent day! I could almost do without my greatcoat."
He bowed towards the other side, kissing his hand.
"Your servant, ma'am." That was an acquaintance of Lady Keith's, large properties in Kent and Sussex.
"Indeed. I should have taken her for a cook."
"Yes. A very fine estate, however, as I was saying. Strong, but not without his weaknesses. He was blaming his particular friend for romantic notions the other day. The friend who was to marry the daughter of that woman we saw just now. And if I had not been so shocked by his condition, I should have been tempted to laugh. He is himself a perfect Quixot, an enthusiastic supporter of the Revolution until 93, a United Irishman until the Rising, Lord Edward's adviser, his cousin, by the way.
Is he Fitzgerald?
The wrong side of the blanket. And now Catalan independence, or perhaps I should say Catalan independence from the beginning, simultaneously with the others. But always heart and soul, blood and purse in some cause, from which he can derive no conceivable personal benefit.
Is he romantic in the common sense?
No. So chaste, indeed, that at one time we were uneasy. Old subtlety was particularly disturbed. There was one liaison, however, and that set our minds at rest. A young woman of very good family. It ended unhappy, of course.
In Pulteney Street they were stopped by two groups of acquaintances, and by one gentleman so highly placed that there was no cutting him short. It was, therefore, some time before they reached Lansdowne Crescent, and when they asked for Dr. Maturin they learnt that he had company. However, after a moment they were asked to walk up, and they found him in bed with a young lady sitting beside him. She rose and curtsied. An unmarried young lady. Their lips tightened. Their chins retreated into the starched white neckcloths. This young person was far, far too beautiful to be described as company, alone in a gentleman's bedroom.
"My dear, allow me to name Sir Joseph Blaine and Mr. Waring."
"Miss Williams," said Stephen. They bowed again, filled with a new respect for Dr. Maturin, and of a different kind. For as she turned and faced the light, they saw that she was a perfectly lovely girl, dewy, fresh, and nonpareil. Sophie did not sit down. She said she must leave them. Indeed, she must, alas. She was to attend her mother to the pump room, and the clock had already struck. But if they would forgive her, she must first... She rummaged in her covered basket, brought out a bottle, a silver tablespoon wrapped in tissue paper, and a box of gilded pills. She filled the spoon, guided it with fixed attention towards Stephen's mouth, poured the glaucous liquid in, fed him two pills, and with a firm benevolence watched them until they had gone down.
"Well, sir,"
said Sir Joseph when the door had closed,
"I congratulate you upon your physician. A more beautiful young lady I do not remember to have seen, and I am old enough to have seen the Duchess of Hamilton and Lady Coventry before they were married. I should consent to have my old cramps redoubled to be dosed by such a hand, and I, too, should swallow it like a lamb."
He smirked. Mr. Waring also smirked. "Be so good as to state your pleasure, gentlemen," said Stephen sharply.
"But seriously, upon my honour," said Sir Joseph, "and with the greatest possible respect for Miss... I do not believe I have ever had so much pleasure at the sight of a young lady. Such grace, such freshness, such colour."
"Ha!" cried Stephen. "You should see her when she's in looks. You should see her when Jack Aubrey's by."
"Ah, so that is the young lady in question? That is the gallant captain's betrothed?" "Yes. How foolish of me. I should have caught the name.
This explains everything.
A pause. Tell me, my dear doctor, is it true that you are somewhat recovered?
Very much so, I thank you. I walked a mile without fatigue yesterday. I dined with an old shipmate. And this afternoon I intend dissecting an aged male pauper with Dr. Trotter. In a week I shall be back in town.
And a hot climate, you feel, would recover you entirely? You can stand great heat?
I am a salamander. They gazed at the salamander, pitifully small and distorted in that great bed. He still looked more fit for a hearse than a chaise, let alone a sea voyage. But they bowed to superior knowledge, and Sir Joseph said,
"Then in that case I shall have no scruple in taking my revenge, and I believe I shall surprise you as much as you surprise me in London. There's many a true word spoken in jest."
A variety of other wise saws sprang to Stephen's indignant mind. Words and feathers are carried off by the wind. As is the wedding, so is the cake. Do not speak Arabic in the house of the Moor. Pleasures pass, but sorrows stay. Love, grief, and money cannot be concealed. But he uttered no more than a sniff, and Sir Joseph continued in his prosy voice,
"There is a custom in the department that when the chief retires he has certain traditional privileges, just as an admiral on hauling down his flag may make certain promotions. Now, there is a frigate fitting out at Plymouth to take our envoy, Mr. Stanhope, to Kampong. The command has been half-promised to three different gentlemen, and there is the usual... In short, I may have the disposal of it. It appears to me that if you were to go with Captain Aubrey, this would rehabilitate you in your purely scientific character. Do you not agree, Waring?"
"Yes," said Waring.
"It will, I trust and pray, restore your health, and it will remove your friend from the dangers you've mentioned. There is everything to be said for it. But there is this grave disadvantage. As you are aware, everything decided by our colleagues in the other departments of the Admiralty or the Navy Office is either carried out with endless deliberation, if indeed it ever reaches maturity, or in a furious hurry. Mr. Stanhope went aboard Deptford a great while ago with his suite, and waited there a fortnight giving farewell dinners. Then they dropped down to the Nore, where he gave two more. Then their lordships noticed that the Surprise lacked a bottom, or masts, or sails, put him ashore in a tempest, and sent her round to Plymouth to be refitted. In the interval he lost his Oriental secretary, his cook and valet, and the prize bull he was to take to the Sultan of Kampong pined away. While the frigate lost most of her active officers by transfer, and a large proportion of her men by the port admiral's drafts. But now all is changed. Stores are hurrying aboard night and day. Mr. Stanhope is posting down from Scotland, and she must sail within the week. Should you be fit to join her, do you think? And is Captain Aubrey at large?"
"Perfectly fit, my dear," cried Stephen, flushing with new life. "And Aubrey left his sponging-house the moment Fanshawe's clerk released him, one tide ahead of a flood of writs. He instantly repaired aboard the press-tender, went up to the Pool of London, and so to ground at the Grapes."
"Let us turn to the details."
"Bondon," cried Stephen, "take pen and ink and write."
"Right, sir,"
cried Bondon.
"Yes.
Sit square to your paper and write Lansdowne Crescent."
"Barrett Bondon, are you brought by the Lee?"
"Why, yes, sir, that I am. Fair brooch, too. Though I can read pretty quick if in broad print. I can make out a watch bill. Never mind.
I shall show you the way of it when we are at sea, however. It's no great matter. Look at the fools you write all day long, but it is useful, my land. You can ride a horse, sure. Which I have rid a horse, sir, and three or four times too, when ashore. Well, be so good as to step, to jump, round to the Paragon, and let Miss Williams know that if her afternoon walk should chance to lead her by Lansdowne Crescent, she would oblige me infinitely. Then, to the Saracen's Head, my compliments to Mr. Pullings, and I should be very glad to see him as soon as he has a moment. Paragon, Issa, and Saracen's Head, to proceed to Lansdowne Crescent at once. You may run, Bondon, if you choose. There is not a moment to be lost. The front door banged, feet tearing away left-handed down the crescent, and a long, long pause. A blackbird singing for the faint approach of spring in the gardens the other side of the road. The dismal voice of a corn-cutter chanting, "Work if I had it, work if I had it," coming closer, dying away. Reflections upon the etiology of corns, upon Mrs. Williams's bile duct. The front door again echoing in the empty house. The Keiths and all their servants, but a single crone, were away. Footsteps on the stairs, continual gay prattle. He frowned. The door opened, and Sophia and Cecilia walked in, with Bondon winking and jerking his thumb behind their heads. "Lord Dr. Maturin," cried Cecilia, "you're abed, I declare. Why, I'm in a gentleman's bedroom at last. That is to say, I don't mean at last at all, but how are you? I suppose you've just come from the bath and are sweating. Well, and how are you? We met Bondon just as we were going out, and I said at once, I must ask how he does. We haven't seen you since Tuesday. Mama was quite..." A thundering double knock below. Bondon vanished. Powerful, sea-going voices on the stairs. A booming remark about the oakum-topped piece, which could only refer to Cecilia and her much-teased yellow hair. And Mr. Pullings made his appearance, a tall, kind-looking, loose-limbed young man, a follower of Jack Aubrey's, as far as so unfortunate a captain could be said to have followers. "You know Mr. Pullings of the Navy, I believe," said Stephen. Of course they knew him. He'd been twice to Melbury Lodge. Cecilia had danced with him. "Such fun!" she cried, looking at him with great complacency. "How I love balls!"
"Your mamma tells me you also have a fine taste in art," said Stephen. "Mr. Pullings, pray show Miss Cecilia Lord Keith's new Titian. It is in the gallery, together with a great many other pictures. And, Pullings, explain the battle scene. The glorious 1st of June. Explain it in particular detail, if you please," he called after them.
"Sophie, my dear, briskly now, take pen and paper. Write. Dear Jack, we have a ship, Surprise, for the East Indies, and must join at Plymouth instantly.
Ha-ha! What'll he say to that?"
"Surprise!" was what he said, in a voice that made the windows of the Grapes One Pair front tremble. In the bar, Mrs. Broad dropped a glass. "The captain's had a surprise," she said, gazing placidly at the pieces. "I hope it's a pleasant one," said Nancy, picking them up. "Such a pretty gentleman."
The travel-worn Pullings discreetly turned to the window as Jack read his letter, spun about at the cry.
"Surprise! God love my heart, Pullings! Do you know what the doctor's done? He's found us a ship! Surprise for the East Indies! Join at once! Killick! Killick!
Sea chest, portmanteau, small valise, and jump round to the office. Insides on the Plymouth Mail.
You won't go jump on no mail coach, sir, said Killick, nor no pochet neither, not with all them bums lining the shore. I'll lay on a hearse, a genteel four-horse hearse.
Surprise! Cried Jack again. I've not set foot in her since I was a midshipman. He saw her plain, lying there a cable's length from him in the brilliant sunshine of English Harbour, a trim, beautiful little 28, French-built, with a bluff bow and lovely lines, weatherly, stiff, a fine seaboat, fast when she was well-hauled, roomy, dry. He'd sailed in her under a taut captain and an even tauter first lieutenant. Had spent hours and hours banished to the masthead, had done most of his reading there, had carved his initials on the cap. Were they still to be seen? She was old, to be sure, and called for nursing, but what a ship to command! He dismissed the ungrateful thought that there was never a prize to be looked for in the Indian Ocean, swept clear long ago, and said, "We could give Agamemnon, mainsail and topgallant sailing on a bowline. I shall have the choice of one or two officers for sure. Shall you come, Pullings?" "Why, of course, sir." Surprised. "Mrs. Pullings, no objection, no... Mrs. Pullings will pipe her eye, I dare say. But then, presently she'll brighten up, and I dare say she'll be main pleased to see me back again at the end of the commission. More pleased than now is, maybe. I get sadly underfoot among the brooms and pans. It ain't like aboard ship, sir, the marriage state." "Ain't it, Pullings?" said Jack, looking at him wistfully. Stephen went on with his dictation. "Surprise. To carry His Majesty's envoy to the Sultan of Kampong. Mr. Taylor at the Admiralty is au courant. Has the necessary papers already. I calculate that if you take the Bath Road and fork off at Day Rolls, you should pass Woolmer Cross at about 4 in the morning of the 3rd, thus going aboard during the debtor's truce of Sunday. I shall wait for you at the Cross for a while in a chaise, and if I am not so fortunate as to see you, I shall proceed with Bondon and expect you at the Blue Posts. She is a frigate, it appears, of the smaller kind. She's short of officers, men, and unless Sir Joseph spoke in jocular hyperbole, of a bottom. In haste. Mend your pace, Sophie. Come, come, you'd never grow fat as a scrivener. Cannot you spell hyperbole? Is it done at last for all love? Show!" "Never," cried Sophie, folding it up. "I believe you put in more than ever I said," said Stephen, narrowing his eyes. "You blush extremely. Have you at least the rendezvous just so?" "Walmer Cross at 4 in the morning of the 3rd. Stephen, I shall be there. I shall get out of my window and over the garden wall. You must take me up at the corner." "Very well. But why will you not walk out of the front door like a Christian? And how are you going to get back? You'll be hopelessly compromised if you're seen stalking about Bath at dawn." "So much the better," said Sophie. "Then I shall have no reputation left whatsoever, and shall have to be married as soon as possible. Why didn't I think of that before? Oh, Stephen, you have beautiful ideas."
"Well, at the corner, then, at 3:30. Put on a warm cloak, 2 pair of stockings and thick woolen drawers. It'll be cold. We may have to wait a great while. And even then, as like as not, we shall not see him, which will chill you even more. For you are to consider that a disappointment on top of the falling damps..." "Hush! Give me the letter."
3:30 in the morning. A strong northeaster howling among the chimney pots of Bath. The sky clear, and a lopsided moon peering down into the Paragon. The door of No. 7 opened just enough to let Sophie out, and then slammed with a most horrid crash, drawing the attention of a group of drunken soldiers who instantly gave tongue. Sophie walked with a great air of resolution and purpose towards the corner, seeing with despair no sign of a coach,
nothing but a row of doorways, stretching on forever under the moon, quite unearthly, strange, inhuman, deserted, and inimical. Steps behind her, overtaking. Faster and faster. A low cry.
"It's me, Miss Bonden."
And in a moment, they were round the corner, climbing into the old leather smell of the first of two post-chaises drawn up at a discreet distance from the house. The postboys' red jackets looked black in the moon. Her heart was going so fast that she could hardly speak for 5 minutes.
"How strange it is at night,"
she said when they were climbing out of the town, "as though everyone were dead. Look at the river, it's perfectly black. I've never been out at this time before."
"No, my dear, I do not suppose you have," said Stephen.
"Is it like this every night?"
"It's sweeter sometimes. This cursed wind blows warm in other latitudes, but always at night the old world comes into its own. Hark there now. Do you hear her? She must be in the woods above the church."
The hellish shrieking of a vixen it was, enough to chill the blood of an apostle. But Sophie was busy peering at Stephen in the faint moonlight, plucking his garments.
"Why," she cried, "you've come out without even so much as your dreadful torn old greatcoat. Oh, Stephen, how can you be so abandoned? Let me wrap you in my cloak. It's lined with fur."
Stephen eagerly resisted the cloak, explaining that once the skin had a certain degree of protection, once it was protected from dissipating its natural heat by a given depth of integument, then all other covering was not only superfluous but harmful. "The case is not the same with the horseman, however," he said. "I strongly recommended Thomas Pullings to place a sheet of oiled silk between his waistcoat and his shirt before setting out. The mere motion of the horse, independently of the velocity of the wind, would carry away the eminent cushion of warmth, could it pierce so far. In a reasonably constructed coach, on the other hand, we need fear nothing of the kind. Shelter from the wind is everything. The contented Eskimo, sheltered in his house of snow, laughs at the tempest and passes his long winter's night in hospitable glee. A reasonably constructed carriage, I say. I should never advise you to career over the steppes of Tartary in a tarantass with your bosom bare to the winds or covered only with a cotton shift, nor yet a jaunting car." Sophia promised that she would never do so, and wrapped in this capacious cloak, they once again calculated the distance from London to Bath, Pullings' speed in going up, Jack's in coming down. "You must make up your mind not to be disappointed, my dear," said Stephen. "The likelihood of his keeping, not the appointment, but rather the suggestion that I threw out, is very slight. Think of the accidents in 100 miles of road, the possibility, nay, the likelihood of his falling off, the horse flinging him down and breaking its knees, the dangers of travel, such as footpads, highwaymen. But hush, I must not alarm you." The post-chaises had slowed to little more than a walk. "We must be near the cross," said Stephen, looking out of the window. Here the road mounted between trees. The white ribbon was lost in long patches of total darkness. Into the trees, whistling and sighing in the northeaster, and there, in one of the pools of light among them, stood a horseman. The postboy caught sight of him at the same moment, reined in, and called back to the chaise behind.
"It's Butcher Geoffrey, Tom. Shall he turn around?"
"There's two more of them behind us. Great, terrible, murdering devils. Do we bide still? I mustn't be me. Mind master's horses and tipping the civil."
The quick, determined clip of hooves, and Sophia whispered, "Don't shoot, Stephen." Glancing back from the open window, Stephen said,
"My dear, I have no intention of shooting. I have
But now here was the horse, pulled up at the window, its hot breath steaming in, and a great dark form leaning low over its withers, shutting out the moonlight and filling the chaise with the civilest murmur in the world.
"I beg your pardon, sir, for troubling you."
"Spare me!" cried Stephen. "Take all I have. Take this young woman, but spare me. Spare me!"
"I knew it was you, Jack," said Sophia, clasping his hand. "I knew directly. Oh, I'm so glad to see you, my dear."
"I will give you half an hour," said Stephen. "Not a moment more. This young woman must be back in her warm bed before cockcrow."
He walked back to the other chaise, where Killick, with infinite satisfaction, was telling Bondon of their departure from London. A hearse, as far as Putney, with Mr. Pullings in a mourning coach behind, bums by the score on either side of the road, pulling their hats off and bowing respectful.
"I wouldn't have missed it. I wouldn't have missed it. No, not for a bosun's warrant."
Stephen paced up and down. He sat in the chaise. He paced up and down. Conversed with Pullings on the young man's Indian voyages. Listened greedily to his account of the prostrating heat of the Hooghly anchorages. The stifling country behind. The unforgivable sun. The heat beating even from the moon by night. "If I do not reach a warm climate soon," he observed, "you may bury me and say he of mere misery perished away." He pressed the button of his repeater, and in a lull of the wind the little silvery bell struck four, and then three for the quarters. Not a sound from the chaise ahead. But as he stood irresolute, the door opened. Jack handed Sophia out and cried, "Bondon! Back to the Paragon and t'other coach with Miss Williams. Come down by the mail. Sophie, my dear, jump in. God bless you.
God bless and keep you, Jack.
Make Stephen wrap himself in the cloak, and remember, for ever and ever, whatever they say, for ever and ever and ever."
Chapter 5 The sun beat down from its noonday height upon Bombay, imposing a silence upon that teeming city, so that even in the deepest bazaars the steady beat of the surf could be heard, the panting of the Indian Ocean, dull ochre under a sky too hot to be blue, a sky waiting for the southwest monsoon. And at the same moment, far, far to the westward, far over Africa and beyond, it heaved up to the horizon and sent a fiery dart to strike the limp royals and t'gallants of the Surprise, as she lay becalmed on the oily swell a little north of the line, and some 30 degrees west of Greenwich. The blaze of light moved down to the topsails, to the courses, shone upon the snowy deck, and it was day. Suddenly the whole of the east was day. The sun lit the sky to the zenith, and for a moment the night could be seen over the starboard bow, fleeting away towards America. Mars, setting a hand's breadth above the western rim, went out abruptly. The entire bowl of the sky grew brilliant, and the dark sea returned to its daily blue, deep blue.
"By your leave, sir," cried the captain of the afterguard, bending over Dr. Maturin and shouting into the bag that covered his head.
"If you please, now."
"What is it?"
asked Stephen at last with a bestial snarl.
"'Nigh on 4 bells, sir.'
"'But what of it? "'Sunday morning, surely to God, and you'd be at your holy stoning?'
"'The bag, worn against the moon, Paul, stifled his words, "'but not the whining tone of a man jerked from total relaxation and an erotic dream. "'The frigate was stifling between decks.' She was more than ordinarily overcrowded with Mr. Stanhope and his suite, and he'd slept on deck, walked upon by each changing watch.
"'These old pitch spots,' said the captain of the afterguard in a wheedling, reasoning voice. "'What would the quarter-deck look like with all these old pitch spots when we come to rig church?'
Then... As Dr. Maturin showed signs of going to sleep again, he returned to, "'Bar your leave, sir, bar your leave, if you please.' In the heat, the tar on the rigging melted and fell on the deck. The pitch used in caulking the seams melted, too, and Stephen, plucking off his bag, saw that they had scrubbed, sanded, and holystoned all round him. That he was in a spotted island surrounded by impatient seamen eager to be done with their work so that they could shave and put on their Sunday clothes. Sleep was hopelessly gone. He stood up, took his head right out of the bag, muttering, "No peace in this infernal hulk or tub. Persecution. Judaic superstitious ritual cleanliness. Archaic fools," and walked stiffly to the side. But as he stood, the sun shot a grateful living warmth right into his bones. A cock in the nearby coop crowed, standing on tiptoe, and instantly a hen cried that she'd laid an egg, an egg. He stretched, gazed about him, met the stony, disapproving faces of the afterguard, and realized that the gumminess of his feet was caused by tar, pitch, and resin on his shoes. A trail of dirty footsteps led across the clean deck from the place where he had slept to the rail where he now stood.
"Oh, I beg your pardon, Franklin," he cried. "I've dirtied the floor, I find. Come, give me a scraper. Sand, a broom."
The harsh looks vanished.
"No, no," they cried. "It was only a little pitch, not dirt. They'd have it off in a moment."
But Stephen had caught up a small holy stone, and he was earnestly spreading the pitch far, deep and wide, surrounded by a ring of anxious, flustered seamen, when 4 bells struck, and to the infinite distress of the afterguard, a huge shadow fell across the deck. The captain, stark naked and carrying a towel.
"Good morning, Doctor," he said. "What are you about?"
"Good morning, my dear," said Stephen. "It is this damned spot, but I shall have him out. I shall extirpate this spot."
"What do you say to a swim?" "With all my heart, in less than a moment. I have a theory. A trifle of sand there, if you please. A small knife."
"No, no. My hypothesis was unsound. Perhaps aqua regia, spirits of salt."
"Franklin, show the doctor how we do it in the Navy. My dear fellow, if I might suggest taking off your shoes, then they might not have to scrub right through the deck and leave His Excellency without a roof to his head."
"An excellent suggestion," said Stephen. He tiptoed barefoot to a carronade and sat looking at his upturned soles. "Marshall tells us that in his day the ladies of the town had sequi me engraved upon their sandals, from which it is reasonable to conclude that Rome was uncommon muddy, for sand would scarcely hold the print. I shall swim the whole length of the ship today." Jack stepped on to the western rail and looked down into the water. It was so clear that he could see the light passing under the frigate's keel.
Her hull projected a purple underwater shadow westwards, sharp head and stern, but vague beneath because of her trailing skirts of weeds. The heavy growth, in spite of her new copper, for they had been a great while south of the tropic. No ominous lurking shape, however.